The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
So during his address yesterday, President Biden predicted Russia will invade Ukraine and said if it's anything more than, quote, a minor incursion, it would be a, quote, disaster for Russia. So how have both Ukraine and Russia responded to these comments? And how has the White House worked to clarify the president's statement?
Well, it was the fact that the president decided to show some sort of differentiation between a minor incursion and an invasion that seems to be the part that is concerning allies, including Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted earlier today, "We want to remind the great powers there are no minor incursions," and said the whole thing could threaten to destabilize the situation even further.
Oil prices hitting a seven-year high on Tuesday, trading in the mid-$80 range, actually above $85 and even higher. Joining us right now with his outlook on where prices are headed is Jeff Currie. He's global head of commodity research at Goldman Sachs. Jeff, early this morning, Richard Engel was on from NBC talking about just the heightened tensions right now between Russia, the United States, the Ukraine, and everything that's happening with NATO. This is something that really matters right now. And maybe we don't talk about it enough, but it certainly looks like it's getting picked up on when it comes to the global markets, especially in the price of oil.
Well, when we look at the movement in the last couple of days, I want to emphasize that it's driven by fundamentals, not the geopolitical risks. Now, the market is much more vulnerable today to these geopolitical risks than ever before, at least over in this cycle, because inventories are so low. So the very tight fundamentals makes the market more exposed to these events. But at this point right now, these geopolitical events really haven't led to any substantial disruptions in supplies of oil around the world. So I want to point out, this market is fundamentally tight. Demand is above supply still. We don't have adequate supplies to cover this demand growth. That's what creates this upside risk. Our target by the second half of this year is over 100 at 105.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks fell over fears of rising interest rates and rising inflation. Janet Yellen also scared the markets by recommending the administration's $5 trillion spending program. But U.S. deficits are growing at nearly half a trillion a month, as we could be at $30 trillion by the end of January. The risk trade has fallen off a cliff as investors rotate into defensive stocks. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up at the top of the hour, John Cozar joins me. John loves gold here as it begins to break out. He sees interest rates crossing over 2%. But John is out of tech, but likes financials, energy, staples, and utilities. Following John, I'll be speaking with Rick Sharga from Realty Track. Rick sees real estate holding up with price increases in the lower digits this year. Rick loves real estate in fast-growing states like Arizona, Texas, Florida, and Nevada. And finally, Chris Sheridan and I will discuss this week's key topic, Inflation Nation, as we see inflation remaining high as more fiscal stimulus, tighter labor markets, and environmental regulations drive up oil prices to over $100 a barrel. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Unfortunately for stocks this week, the selling has been relentless. The buy-the-dip mentality has finally been overwhelmed by sell-the-rally momentum. A perfect example of this was Thursday when the Russell 2000 Small Cap Index closed down 1.9% after being up 2% intraday. The Nasdaq Composite fell 1.3% Thursday after being up 2.1% intraday. And the S&P 500 declined 1.1% after being up 1.5%. On that close, the S&P 500 was down 7% from its all-time high, and when markets fail to close on bounces and reverse, the mentality is that the dip is going to keep on dipping. We've been tracking fund flows this month to discern where the money's going, and the money's leaving passive indexes in equities and bond funds like the SPY, IVV, QQQs, IWM, as well as TLT and HYQ in fixed income, and being deployed in financial total stock market ETFs, energy ETFs, and foreign indices without the U.S. inside ETFs, and on the fixed income side, going into aggregate bond funds and bank loan ETFs. This week, the news was light and didn't change the narrative. More, it seemed to reinforce at the company-specific level why stocks may be overpriced and due the ongoing correction. For example, Tuesday, Goldman Sachs missed earnings due to sharp increases in compensation expenses. Going into this earnings season, this was one of the two big fears, the other of waning demand due to high prices. Goldman Sachs continued the trend from last week's financial earnings with a decline of 7% post-earnings. Thursday, CNBC reported that Peloton is temporarily pausing production of its bikes due to a drop in demand. That's second fear. The stock fell 24% on the day, even as the company was down more than 80% from its highs from last year. The stock rallied Friday after the CEO told employees he's not looking to shut down production on all bikes, but the damage continues to show that even in beleaguered stocks like Peloton, the damage in growth stocks may not be done. The same sentiment in Peloton Thursday was found in Netflix Friday, which forecasted slower subscriber growth for the first quarter this year, a miss in fourth quarter global paid net additions and downside revenue guidance. The stock was down 20% last I checked, keeping a lid on any rally in growth stocks, even as rates were coming down towards the end of the week. A couple of airline companies reported earnings this week, with American Airlines, United Airlines. Both gave cautious outlooks and saw a drop of around 3% in the prices on the day. Despite a lot of negative reactions in earnings, there were also some positive ones. Overall, FactSet is estimating year-over-year earnings growth for the S&P 500 around 21.8% as of the end of this week for the fourth quarter, and estimates that could possibly go up to more than 25% by the end of the season as companies continue to report. The 10-year Treasury yield peaked at 1.86% on Tuesday, only to see a flight to safety in bonds drive rates back down to 1.75% by Friday. But that drop did little to help rally growth and tech stocks. The tiered treasury yield hovered around 1.03% most of the week. Next week, be on the lookout. The Fed will be meeting, and continued concerns are that it will be hawkish in its comments. Our growth outlook agrees, and we think the Fed will allow a correction in stocks as it focuses on inflation. Right now, the Fed funds futures still point to a very high probability rates will go up 25 basis points in March. And as I've been mentioning as of last week, we've been continuing to see commentary from Fed speakers that we could be seeing 4 hikes this year and not just 3. And even more so, we've seen the Fed fund futures moving up in predictions of possibly more than just a 25 basis point hike in March, possibly 50 points. So we're going to be on the lookout for what the Fed mentions next week. That'll be a key market mover. On the economic front, we had mixed manufacturing data. The Empire Manufacturing Survey showed a drop in January to negative 0.7 from 31.9, while the Philadelphia Fed Index increased to 23.2 from 15.4. Home sales data was disappointing, down 4.6% in December and down 7.1% from a year ago, based on high sales prices in a tight supply market and now rising mortgage rates. Initial claims went up for the week ending January 15th, up 55,000 to 286,000, while continuing claims also up 84,000 to 1.63 million. The view is that Omicron variant of COVID is impacting the labor market and will likely give a bad print for January for non-farm payrolls in just a couple of weeks here. Finally, Friday, the conference board's leading economic index for December rose 0.8% following a revised increase 0.7% in November. So again, the selling's been relentless. We have not seen a buy the dip rally able to sustain itself. And that's how we leave the market here on this Friday. Have a great weekend. And up next is our technician for the week. Take care.
I do believe that we are looking at a very important medium-term peak, but I do not believe that it's the end of this current market cycle. I think the market cycle will most likely stretch into 24. But what we are facing now is a very decisive decline.
To listen to this full interview with the legendary Swiss strategist and investor, Felix Zuloff, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market continues to correct. How long will this correction last? Will it become more serious? Well, let's look into this in depth. Joining me on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, let's take it from the top. You've got several key indicators that you use. Let's begin with your Asbury 6. What is that telling you about where we are in this market right now?
It's telling us that the internals of the market have been negative for about a week. The model turned to negative on January the 14th, just about a week ago. Five of the six of the Asbury 6 are negative. The Asbury 6 is a model that we put together because just looking at the S&P and trying to make a determination of what the market is doing, I mean, all that really does is makes me dizzy now. You really need more, kind of need to look under the hood of the market, as I like to call it, because, you know, the computers, the algos, I think, kind of rule the roost day to day. And just like I'm looking, you know, we were down 44 yesterday and I'm looking up and now we're up 55. Who knows where we're going to close? So we're looking at stuff like high yield corporate bond spreads and volume and market breadth and asset flows into key ETFs like spiders. And we look for four or more of those six to be either positive green or negative red, and now they're currently red, which suggests the market is more vulnerable. The market is vulnerable to more weakness.
And your correction protection model is confirming that, I see.
Yes, that just went negative a day or two ago. And the thing about CPM, that's what we call it, is I built the model for older RIAs. We work with a lot of RIAs. We work with a lot of older, wealthier investors that need to be in the market, but don't. It's hard for them to be able to handle the risk involved in that. Just like I said, up 50 today and down 50 tomorrow, you know, really makes this, I think, so some people can't sleep at night. So what the correction protection model does is it basically sucks the risk out of the market. The beta on the CPM over the past 11 years has been 0.43, and the S&P, of course, is 1.0. So it takes about half of that risk out of the market, at least according to beta. Standard deviation is much lower. Drawdowns are less than half. So it tends to move a little bit slower than the Asbury 6. The Asbury 6 is more sensitive. But yes, it did go risk off a couple of days ago.
You know, I'm looking at the S&P 500 sectors, and about the only thing that seems to be holding up is staples and, of course, energy with oil prices where they are. But everything else, let's talk about the NASDAQ and technology, because the NASDAQ broke through its 200-day moving average. Today, it's trying to touch that again. Whether it breaks through or not, we don't know yet at this point. What's your take on the NASDAQ here?
The NASDAQ, both NASDAQs have been pretty elusive, but it's probably not the best adjective. Yeah, they've underperformed. Like I'm looking at the comp. I'm looking at the NASDAQ Composite Index, which is, of course, the broader one. Underperformed last year from February to May. And then it basically, it had a little bit of outperformance up until June. And then really by the 4th of July, it was just a relative performer versus the S&P 500. Outperforming for 2 weeks, underperforming for 2 weeks, but not to any huge magnitude. But now what I see on that chart is that relative performance low, in other words, where the comp was weakest versus the S&P going back a few years, was right around the lows last year, relatively speaking, middle of May. We're testing those now. just as we're breaking through the 200-day moving average. So if we can hold this breakdown through the 200-day and we make new relative performance lows both at the same time, that's bad news. That, to me, could signal the next gear in this emerging correction for the entire market.
Let's move to another sector asset class, and that's commodities. You know, gold looks like it's trying to break out. We've got oil going to higher levels. Let's talk about commodities for a minute and what this is telling us.
Three of our picks right now over at Asbury here are corn, soybeans, and we just bought gold yesterday, the day before yesterday. We just bought gold. The reason we waited is up until a couple of days ago, gold was underperforming the S&P 500 on a quarterly basis. So in my world, if gold's going up, but it's still underperforming the S&P 500, why not just be in stocks? That is no longer the case. So, you know, I'm seeing precious metals. You mentioned, obviously, gold. Copper has been doing better. I've been watching some of the lumber ETFs. They've been a little bit choppy lately, but they're suggesting to me that they could be moving higher. So I think the longer this pullback in the S&P, you know, correction, whatever it's going to develop into, keep in mind, this is seasonally a bad place for the stock market until we get really until the latter part of February, you know, beginning of March. The more weakness we see in the stock market, I think the more relative opportunities I'm going to be seeing in some of the commodity spaces, some of the commodity markets, and we're going to continue to put those out there to clients just so you have a place to hide. If we are indeed going into a correction here that's going to last a couple of months, it's nice to have that money allocated somewhere where you can make a return while you're waiting for a better place to get back in the market.
Everybody's talking about inflation. It'll peak in the first half of the year. Fed kind of puts the brakes on a bit. But the Fed can't control barrels of oil. So what happens if gold continues to rise, or let's say oil does, because some are predicting we could hit 100. I mean, we're not too far from that now. Roughly about a little over 85 bucks a barrel.
I look at these correlations periodically. I try to look to see if there's a linear correlation between gold bonds or oil and bonds. There's been loose linear correlations there over the past 5 years. They go in, they go out. But generally speaking, if this is the start of a bigger move in these two, I think it would dovetail with inflationary pressures not being able to be quickly smothered out. I mean, we've had virtually zero interest rates for a decade or more. I mean, I wish it was just that easy. I'll throw a couple of wet towels over it and we'll be good to go on the 4th of July. I don't know that that's going to be the case. I think easy money for a long time to get these inflation sparks turning into flames. And sometimes it takes a while to turn them off again. I started in these markets down on the trading floor in 1980, when gold was $800 an ounce. And I think, short-term interest rates were 21%. You know, my first mortgage was 11.5% in the middle to late. So I think it's easier said than done. I think if it was so easy just to throw a little, just to raise short-term interest rates, 50 or 100 basis points, and we're all hunky-dory again, I just don't think that's real world.
No, I don't either. It's just like if you remember last year, the consensus was, well, inflation was starting to pick up, but it's all transitory. Well, by the end of the year, we switched from transitory to something more serious. That's why I guess when I look at the consensus for the year, hey, it's going to be a little rough and tumble the first 6 months of the year. Fed will raise interest rates, and then it's going to be, like you said, hunky-dory for the rest of the year. I don't know if I'm going to buy that. But, you know, in the meantime, as you're looking at this market, you like energy. You just bought gold this week. Any other trends that you think you and I were talking about just before we went on the air? You have this U.S. versus the world model, and now you're starting to see foreign stock markets outperform the U.S. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's really interesting to watch. We update the model once a week, and it tends to be a little bit slower moving, and it's based on relative performance. So for most of last year, the model just showed that the U.S. was beating everything else. We look at relative performance in three different timeframes, and then we look to find a trend across various timeframes, week, a month, a quarter, like that. So second half of last year, the U.S. was beating just about everything in just about every time frame. Just between the last, I'm actually scrolling down there, my comment is over just the past several weeks or so, global equity investors have made a definitive shift away from the U.S. Through last week, 10 of the 24 foreign markets that are model tracks are now outperforming the S&P 500 on a trading basis, a tactical basis, and a strategic basis. And that means weekly, monthly, quarterly. And 11 other markets are outperforming on a trading and a tactical basis. So in other words, they haven't gotten all the way out to the quarterly performance yet, but they are showing trends in those shorter time periods. So that's a big move. Heading into this week, Peru was one that showed up on our model a few weeks ago. It's outperformed SPY by 12.3% since 1.4. Mexico is outperformed by 3.7% since 12.30. That's DIS 30. And Taiwan is outperformed by 3.4% since 12.29. So all of these trends have just bubbled up here right around Christmas time.
So, John, given where we are right now and what your models are telling you, if you had money to put to work, where would you put it?
Well, we have a sector rotation model that doesn't follow performance. It actually follows money flows in and out of the 11 sector spiders. It's the SEAF model. It stands for Sector ETF Asset Flows. That tells us where the money is going, and I trade that one personally. And that one currently is showing that the push of money is going into financials and energy, has for the past couple of weeks, and out of technology. So let's say hypothetically, 2 months from now, we're in the second month of a correction and the S&P has lost another 400 points. That model will still show me where the money's moving. And I may end up in staples and utilities. And you know, so the S&P loses 12% and those two may lose 7. For most investors that want to be mostly invested in the market, you know, that's a win. You're still outperforming. So I think I follow the money in the sector space. I've already reduced my exposure in overall equity space by about a third because of our CPM and Asbury 6 models. And I'm looking for more gold and soybeans and corn and stuff of that nature. So maybe I have a place to hide where I can outperform and maybe, you know, capture some outright performance until the sun shines again in the equity space. And I get to take some of that money and reallocate it lower. That's what I'm hoping is we have a sharp correction here. We're certainly due some, you know, for something. I'd love to see it. I'd love to be able to pull that money out of the market, park it somewhere to make a return and be able to reallocate all that money down low sooner. So yeah, I think you look overseas. If you want to keep some money in equities, I think you look at some of these ideas and equities and spread it around the globe a little bit. I'm seeing most of the activity is coming out of Western Europe. I'm seeing it in Spain, UK, Switzerland is another one. France is another one. But ultimately, I'm crossing my fingers that we get a really nice kind of flush out and we could buy stocks sometime later this year at significantly lower prices.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about what you guys do at Asbury, how can they do so?
I think the best thing to do is visit our website, asburyresearch.com, and go to the contact tab. We actually are offering, we have 3-month and 12-month research subscriptions. We're offering 10% off through the end of January. So you only got about 10 days left or so, but we have an email for that that has links to our models. There's some performance information there, hypothetical performance information there, sample copies of some of the reports we do. We'll send that over to you. And if anything else, you'll at least get a little more comprehensive look at how we approach investing, which is a little different. A lot of our, all of our models are internal. It's stuff that I've come up with over the years.
Well, listen, John, as always, thanks for coming on the program. A happy new year and prosperous new year to you and hope to talk to you again.
Looking forward to it. Happy New Year to all that are listening. And Jim, I'll speak to you again in a few months.
Right now, the Chinese property market is frozen. In other words, buyers and sellers can't agree on price. The gap is too large. But usually what happens after frozen situations, frozen markets, is that those markets collapse. And I think China is pretty much there. I mean, Beijing is trying to support it. But the point is that there's too many apartments and not enough potential purchasers. And this is important because something you alluded to, and that is that 70% of the wealth of the Chinese people tied up in property. So this has ramifications across the economy.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, real estate prices have been going up year after year. It just seems like it's been nonstop since the financial crisis. Will this continue now as inflation rises? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Rick Sharga. Rick, you just put out a report that real estate investors are pessimistic on the current near-term market. Explain what you mean by that.
You know, first of all, Jim, thanks for having me back. It's always fun to have conversations with you. Yeah, our most recent RealtyTrack investor sentiment survey showed that about half of individual investors who buy real estate are concerned about the state of the market, primarily for two reasons. One is the ongoing severe lack of inventory that's available to purchase. And the other is rapidly rising prices of those properties. We've seen property values go up nationally somewhere between 18 to 20% year over year. We're probably not quite in a bubble yet, but if prices keep going up at that rate, we certainly will be soon. And that's affecting investors' ability to buy properties at a price that will allow them to either profit on a fix and flip or rent out properties at a monthly rental rate that's affordable for potential renters. So very real concerns. And candidly, this is the first time we've done the survey where the outlook for the subsequent 6 to 12 months hasn't been much more positive than the current market.
And Rick, what about the affordability index, which is just not only price, mortgage rate, and things of that nature? It's got to be falling with prices rising and mortgage rates rising.
Yeah, the historically low interest rates that we've been really spoiled by over the last couple of years have kept properties surprisingly affordable when you look at the monthly payments. So even though the top line home prices have gone up significantly, having 30-year fixed rate loans available at 2.5%, 2.75% has kept those monthly payments within the reach of a lot of buyers. We're seeing interest rates up almost a full point from those lows today. Most of the economists that I follow and our own projections suggest that we're going to see rates probably end the year somewhere in the neighborhood of 4%. And that has a dramatic impact on the affordability for a lot of potential home buyers and investors who are right there on the margin in terms of being able to buy something or not. We're already seeing price corrections at the high end of the market. So if you look at coastal California, the Bay Area, the Pacific Northwest, some markets that were incredibly priced in 2021, like Boise and Austin, at the high end of the market in those areas, we're seeing list price reductions. We're seeing a little bit of a price correction taking place. Don't expect to see home prices fall nationally year over year. But in certain pockets and at certain price tiers, I think you're going to have to see prices come down a little bit or people are just not going to be able to buy them.
Let's talk about what some people are calling Californization, and that's Californians selling their grossly overvalued properties. I don't care if you're San Francisco, LA, even San Diego. You sell your, you know, if you're a homeowner here, you know, you're worth over $1 million. So you sell your house here. They've been moving to Nevada, they've been moving to Texas, to Arizona, to Florida, to Boise. Talk about the impact of Californians moving out and going elsewhere, driving up prices.
Californians are not popular in a lot of parts of the country, even more than usual, Jim. Boise is a great example. Boise home prices last year went up between 45 and 47% on a year-over-year basis, which is just completely insane. And a lot, and that clearly wasn't driven by underlying market dynamics that made Boise some sort of economic powerhouse. It was folks moving in from out of state, primarily from California, doing exactly what you just said. They would cash out on their California property. They'd move into Boise. They'd buy a bigger house on a bigger property. And they didn't really care if they were paying 20, 30, 40% over list price because it was still costing them half of what they just cashed out when they sold their California house. The local Boise residents weren't crazy about it. I guess if you were a homeowner, your assumed house value went up significantly. But if you were trying to buy a house, you were getting priced out of the market by people moving in from out of state. And Boise is probably the most extreme example of that. But there are other places that nobody had ever heard of really until last year, like St. George's, Utah, which is not too far from Salt Lake City, that had a huge influx. Dallas-Fort Worth and Austin saw huge price increases because of an influx of California buyers. So that impact has happened in multiple places across the country. As Californians, now that they can work from home, have opted to move into lower price, lower tax, higher quality of life areas.
You know, it was amazing. I was talking to my realtor and I said, who's buying these places down in San Diego? And she was telling me what you just said. A lot of the tech people up in Silicon Valley, they can work remotely. You come down to San Diego compared to San Francisco looks much cheaper. So you got a lot of San Francisco people buying down here.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You're going from an incredibly expensive market to a moderately expensive market. And it feels like a huge windfall. And then you have people leaving from San Diego to go to Dallas. Who says trickle-down economics doesn't work? It's interesting. And the real question, when the game of musical houses stops, is who's buying the most expensive properties in those most expensive markets? Or is that where things really do start to come to a screeching halt in terms of the housing market?
You know, it was amazing. I was talking to a realtor in Scottsdale, and the prices in Scottsdale, Rick, look like California. I can't believe what's happened to prices there.
Yeah, it's not quite as bad. I just spoke at an event there last month. And, you know, when you're driving around town with your Uber driver, you get a lot of local market info. But there's virtually nothing to buy in Scottsdale. So Scottsdale is kind of a microcosm of the housing market nationally, where there's a lot of demand. And to your point, a lot of it is from out-of-staters, particularly people coming from the northern part of the country. And there's nothing to buy. So everything becomes a competitive bidding situation, which drives prices up. So yeah, the prices in Phoenix and Scottsdale over the last year went up dramatically. I think they were both probably over 30%. And we've just seen, you know, pockets of the country, Florida, particularly for people moving from northeastern states and the Midwest, it has been just red hot in terms of its housing market. And, you know, for the foreseeable future, that it doesn't look like that's going to slow down. I think the demand is still outpacing the supply. And again, with the ability to work from almost anywhere, we have a lot of professionals who are moving from high cost, high tax markets into places where their money's going to go a lot further.
You know, the thing that really strikes me with these 16, 18% price increases, Rick, let's talk about inventory, because whether you're looking in Scottsdale, whether you're looking in Reno, whether you're looking in Vegas, the inventory levels are low. And you would think with price increases, the builders would be going all out building as many homes as they can.
You would think that. And in fact, housing numbers or housing start numbers just came out that showed that in December, housing starts were at an annual rate of 1.7 million. That's the highest number we've seen since, I believe, 1974. So the builders are trying to do their part. They're facing three headwinds that are making it difficult for them to build more. There is a critical shortage of skilled labor. The supply chain disruptions that we've read about in terms of causing inflation are really hammering the builders. You know, it's taking them a year to get windows and 9 months to get roofing materials and so forth and so on. And there's a lack of available lots for them to build on. And they have to go through all sorts of gyrations with state and local governments and zoning boards to get those lots approved and ready to go. So they would be building more if they could. The other critical housing shortage, Jim, is existing homes. And you can blame the builders for not having new homes that those existing homeowners can move into. But I can't tell you how many people I've talked to, and this is anecdotal, of course, who would love to take advantage of today's high prices to sell their house, but they are scared to death they won't be able to find a place to live if they do that. Apartment vacancy rates in the multifamily market across the country are less than 2%, lowest it's been in history. And so, you know, the people who might downsize to rent have nowhere to move and are afraid to put their house on the market because they may not be able to find something to buy after they sell it.
I have, I would say, Rick, almost 40% of our clients who are retiring from California are moving elsewhere. They're moving to Nevada. Idaho is one area. Texas is another. Florida is another. But one of the things that one of my clients told me, he said, you know, I sold my home and I'm feeling so wealthy until I look at what I'm going to have to pay elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. There is a wealth effect, a psychological wealth effect that comes with having home equity. And look, home equity has never been higher. The last published report I saw, and I suspect it's low now, showed that there was over $23 trillion in homeowner equity across the country. That's a record. Our parent company, RealtyTrack's parent company, Adam Data Solutions, puts out a quarterly home equity report. And in the last report, it showed that more than a quarter of homeowners have more than 50% equity. And that's just homeowners with an active mortgage, by the way. That's not counting people where the mortgage has been paid off. I did a little bit further digging. Even people that are currently in foreclosure, and that's a low number today, but even the people that are in foreclosure, 87% of them have positive equity. So you feel that wealth, to your point, until you have to buy something else. A good friend of mine moved from Orange County, California to Austin for a job a little over a year ago and was pleasantly surprised at how much house he could buy with the money that he made on the sale of his California property. And was really happy until he got his tax bill. and property taxes in Texas are significantly higher than they are here. So, you know, there's pros and cons of living almost anywhere in the country. But I think you're right. And I think there is a trend going on. Last year was the first year in decades where California had a net loss of population. It was in the six figures, which I think is significant. And I do think it's a lot of people who are retiring or who have amassed some equity and have the opportunity to work from anywhere and are just choosing to move to where, again, where their dollar goes further in terms of housing and living costs.
You know, the thing that really surprises me about all of this, you look at the price of real estate, it's not just the fact that homes are going up. You know, here in California, if you look at rental properties and what people are having to pay for rent, I keep hearing from a lot of our clients that their kids are having a hard time finding, you know, places to rent that they can afford.
Well, it's all tied together. There's a fallacy that as home ownership rates go up, rental prices go down. That's simply not the case. We've done some analysis that shows that in over 60% of the major metros across the country, it's actually more affordable to make a monthly mortgage payment than it is to make a monthly rent payment. And that's because of those historically low interest rates that we talked about a few minutes ago. If you're looking at asking prices for new tenants in the multifamily market, they went up 14% year over year, which is wow. off the charts. There's a critical lack of supply. That number usually goes up somewhere between 1% and 5% a year. So to see a 14% jump is just unprecedented. The good news, if you're looking at supply and demand, is that there's something like 750,000 new units currently under construction, with probably more being started to meet that demand. So the builders, I really do believe, have come out of hibernation and are trying to catch up, but it's not something they can fix overnight.
So given the fact that the Fed is in a tightening mode and could be in that mode for several years, just like last time when they tried to raise the Fed funds rate, so that would imply, you know, mortgage rates are heading up. So looking forward, What would you be doing if you were a homeowner thinking of, number one, trading up? Let's take that person. Let's take the person that is a first-time home buyer. Let's say a millennial couple. They want to have children. They want to move into a house instead of living in an apartment. That couple. And then finally, the third couple. Let's take somebody that lives in either California or someplace like that. They're thinking of retiring, getting out, live someplace where it's less expensive. What would you be doing in all three cases?
As you pose the question, I'm thinking to myself how happy I am that I'm not one of those three situations just yet. It is a rough time to be a home buyer. Now, that said, we're still seeing, I guess we saw probably 6.1, 6.2 million successful transactions like that last year. We'll probably see a similar number again this year. I think the answer to most of those questions is you have to cast a very wide net. The fastest growing segments we saw in terms of home purchasing last year were the far suburbs and areas, actually near rural areas. The other trend we saw last year was a move from high-cost urban areas to lower-cost urban areas, and that usually meant crossing state lines. And I think that's really the message for people. You know, Jim, you and I are both in California. There's an area called the Inland Empire, which is east of Los Angeles and San Diego counties, and for forever has been a bedroom community for those counties. So people would go out there to buy homes because they were less expensive, and they would commute to their jobs, horrible commutes in many cases, to LA County and Orange County and San Diego County. And that was sort of one of the most hard hit areas in the country during the last foreclosure crisis. There's a big difference in areas like the Inland Empire across the country today, because what's happening is people are moving out there and buying houses, but they're finding jobs there. And we've seen the Amazons and the Walmarts and other online retailers of the world create new jobs with warehouses and distribution centers that are in those second tier markets. And then businesses pop up to support those warehouses and distribution centers, and businesses pop up to support those businesses. And so suddenly they're not bedroom communities anymore. They're actual communities where people live and work. And I think that's a trend that we're going to continue to see as millennials move further away from urban centers to find their first home because it's more affordable the further away they get from the urban center. People retire into smaller markets. And this is the kind of thing where, on the one hand, you want to say wait because home prices are as high as they are. But home prices are likely to continue to go up, although at a slower rate this year than last year. But you're also going to see interest rates go up, and the Fed funds rate doesn't directly impact mortgage rates, but it certainly sets the tone for the lending environment. And if we're going to see 2-3 Fed fund rate increases from the Fed, and if we stay in a high inflation market, both of those things tend to point toward higher mortgage rates. So in a lot of ways, strike now, the sooner the better, because it's only likely to get more expensive over the next year.
So as we look at, in summing this up, the real estate market, you can't call it a bubble, because usually in a bubble, not only are prices soaring like they are now, but there's abundant supply because people react to higher prices and bring more product online. We're not seeing that with supply chain problems and shortage of labor.
We're also not seeing the kind of speculative buying that is typically exemplified by a bubble. The price increases are coming basically because consumers are competing with each other for limited inventory. The other thing to keep in mind about these prices, there's two things that make the prices a little high, well, appear a little higher than they are for practical purposes. One is that the numbers that are reported are on median prices. And if you remember your sixth grade math, the median point is the midpoint between the high and the low. Well, there's nothing for sale at the low end of the market. So if your lowest price property is higher because there's nothing available, that pushes your median up. Doesn't mean that every house in the market has gone up 18 to 20% in price. It means that median has gone up in part because the low end of the market is absent. The other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people are buying these really expensive houses by making really hefty down payments based on the equity they had in their previous house. 70% of the market is not first-time home buyers. So we talked about Boise earlier. Those prices are going way, way up, but people aren't coming in with risky financing. They're, in a lot of cases, paying cash. But even the people that are moving up into higher priced houses who are financing are very often coming in with 30, 40% down payments, which again is very different than what you typically see in a bubble environment. The other thing that you would usually see in a bubble environment is a huge difference in the price of a house versus what you pay in rent. And as you and I talked about just a couple minutes ago, rent prices are going through the roof too. So this really is a supply-demand driven market at the moment. And until we have a little bit better balance between supply and demand, it's not likely to get much better if you're looking to buy.
You know, it's amazing, Rick, as we close this supply-driven demand market that we're talking about, you're seeing it in big-ticket items. I don't care if it's homes. If you want to buy I'm a sailor. You want to buy a boat, good luck. You're lucky if you get delivery in 2023. If you want to buy an RV, if you want to buy, I just sold a boat, and it's the first time in boating history for me. I sold a boat for more than what I paid for it. I mean, that's how crazy it is here.
My daughter is in her second year of college, and it's mostly virtual, so she's commuting. And we're four of us in the family. We have three cars, and there are days when another car would be useful. And try and find a used car today on a lot somewhere where the price makes any sort of sense at all. Critical shortage of used cars. So it's everything right now. And my concern, people ask, what could go wrong in the market? And we've been talking about the Fed. The inflation rate right now is running at about 7%, highest it's been in 40 years. And the Fed has a long, proud history of overcorrecting. I liken it to being on an icy road at night and trying to slow down. And the smart way to do it is to tap your brakes gently, steer into the direction of the car and gradually work your way off to the side of the road. The other alternative is to slam on the brakes and wind up in a ditch. And often when the Fed tries to correct the economy, we wind up in that ditch. And that's how a lot of the recessions since World War II have been started, by the Fed overcorrecting to get inflation under control or to slow down an overheating economy. And that's something I think we have to watch for as the Fed winds down its quantitative easing, as it talks about Fed fund rate increases. What's the risk that they overcorrect and, as a way of trying to slow down inflation, actually push us into a recession? The good news is those types of recessions tend to be fairly mild and fairly short. But if you're looking for something that could put the economy off the rails, that to me looks like the most likely scenario.
Well, we have a saying here on the show, they'll keep raising rates till they break something. And usually 95% of the time, they break something. Well, listen, Rick, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you guys do at Realty Track, how can they do so, please?
Well, they can certainly visit our Realty Track blog. Realty Track is spelled R-E-A-L-T-Y-T-R-A-C. We post on the blog a couple times a week. Follow us on Twitter or sign up with us on LinkedIn. They can also follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter. It's simply Rick Sharga. And I'm posting this kind of stuff all the time. But really do appreciate the opportunity, Jim, to catch up with you again, have another good conversation, and hopefully your listeners will find this useful.
All right. Well, we certainly appreciate it, Rick. Come back and talk to us again.
Jim, starting in early 2020, just after the COVID crash and massive stimulus programs that were being launched, you began warning of an incoming inflationary wave and that the smart money was now in the process of hedging this outcome by increasing their exposure to energy, hard assets, and commodities. For most of that time, from early 2020 up until today, as inflation started to build, of course, the Fed and consensus economic opinion was that no worry, inflation would prove to be transitory, and we continue to push against that view on our show and in articles, saying that it would be persistent, and as of last year, in 2021 warned on multiple occasions that when it comes to just how long persistent may last, that this is not just simply an issue for all of 2021 or even most of this year in 2022, but a problem that we are likely to be grappling with for the remainder of this entire decade. So with the stage set on where we stand on this issue and what we've been telling investors now for well over a year and a half, let's start with one of the main reasons you think that inflation isn't going away anytime soon, something that a number of other big thinkers are also warning about.
Well, I mean, if we take a look at how we got here, everything that you are seeing today, whether it's supply shortages, COVID, the inflation numbers, high energy prices, all of these are the result of government policies. And let's begin with COVID. The first thing that you remember in 2020, it was flatten the curve. Well, what we did is flatten the economy. So we were supposed to shut down the economy. That was going to cause it to go away. Well, that didn't happen. Then we went to, okay, well, we have to have vaccines. And if we get the vaccine, then that'll end COVID. Well, that turned out not to be true. Then we went to boosters. Still, COVID is growing. There's more people that have died and have gotten COVID in the last year than the previous year. So everything from lockdowns to mandates, and what Wall Street is not factoring in is what's going to happen on the labor front, which was the big push behind inflation in the 70s. When we take a look at fiscal policies of injecting money into the economy, and this gets back to the classic definition of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. And then the other factor that's going on at the same time, this green transition. So the Biden administration, his first act as president was to kill the Keystone Pipeline, issue executive orders on drilling on federal lands, and look at where we are with energy a year later. The Fed's money printing. You know, there's been a lot of criticism that the Fed waited too long and admitted its mistake where they thought inflation was transitory, which it's proving not to be. And then you combine these massive government spending programs along with deficits, and we're going to get to that and where this is going to end up in the long run. But all of this inflation, Chris, whether it's what we're seeing with COVID, whether we're seeing it with supply chain, all of this is government policy driven. And the reason I'm bringing this up, you're hearing, well, it's the meat packers. They're charging too much. Or it's the oil companies. They're gouging consumers. It's whatever group we demonize, we blame inflation on rather than taking a look at its root cause, which is policy.
Well, Jim, I don't know about you, but Elizabeth Warren the other day, I heard her on the news talking about the cabal of grocery stores, that they've all come together and they're price gouging consumers by raising prices on their goods. So, I mean, maybe we're missing something here.
Well, I mean, well, that's typical of government. They're not going to go, well, it's our policies. We made a mistake. We're going to change and pivot and change course. That's not happening. The president gave a major press conference yesterday, and there's not one word of pivot in anything that he's doing. He said, you know, he claims he's done more as president than any other president in U.S. history. I don't know if everybody's buying into that, but nonetheless, we always find inflation. Politicians are always apt to blame somebody who's raising prices. If grocery stores, if groceries are going up, well, it's the grocery stores. If meat is going up, it's the meat packers. If the oil's going up, it's the oil companies. And what are they going to say about labor? When labor rates start going up and labor inflation, something we're going to be dealing with in the latter half of this year, and that is not going to go away, and we're going to get into that in just a moment. But nonetheless, Chris, the reason we stuck to the inflation scenario 2 years ago is we saw this as being policy driven. The spending reactions that with the stimulus that we did as we shut down the economy, instead we gave people, what, $3 trillion in stimulus in the Trump administration to spend money to make up for the fact that we were shutting the economy down. We did the same thing in 2021. And they're, believe it or not, they're talking about another stimulus for COVID. I mean, this is absolutely insane. And we're going to get to this when we show you what's going on with the deficit. But let's talk about something the market isn't looking at. And that is labor shortages and wage hikes. I mean, what did we saw in the month of December? 4.5 million people quit work. We have 12.5 million jobs that are unfilled right now. And if we take a look at the economists and the administration, the solution is, well, if we spend more money, we'll make inflation go away. And this brings me back to the 1970s when they analyzed why inflation was so persistent. It was a series of bad economic advice. You know, we've seen it. We've seen it from Janet Yellen, who's Treasury Secretary. We need to spend more money. She was for the $5 trillion Build Back Better plan, or I call it Build Back Broke or Build Back Bad, whatever you want to call it. You've had prominent economists in the administration are saying that we need to spend more money. And they're talking about another COVID stimulus. I mean, this is just crazy. And one of the things that we've been seeing in this corporate earnings season, a lot more companies are feeling comfortable enough to pass on these cost increases that they're seeing with wages, cost of materials, to pass them on to consumers. And that, Chris, I think is going to continue.
Jim, you were telling me before we started just how quickly we're seeing an increase in debt levels and some of the things that we're seeing on that side of things with government debt and deficits. Do you mind sharing a bit of those numbers and just how alarming we're seeing debts rise today?
Yeah, and we're going to put two links on the site. We have the government debt going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century. And this will give you an idea of how fast all those programs. Remember, Trump had a $3 trillion stimulus bill that they passed. And then the last month of Trump's presidency, they passed $900 billion in stimulus. Then Biden comes in January and passes $1.9 trillion in stimulus. Then they just passed $1.2 trillion in stimulus on the infrastructure. So we have spent almost $6 trillion in stimulus since COVID began. Well, now those chickens are coming home to roost. And let me give you an example. The government's fiscal year ends September 2021. At that point, at the end of September, the national debt stood at $28.4 trillion. December, the last full month that we have debt, rose to $29,590,000,000. So we went up almost $1.2 trillion in 3 months. And the debt now is growing at $400 billion a month. We're into third week in January, and the national debt is now approaching $30 trillion. We're only a little over $100 trillion away from $30 trillion. So we have debt now growing up at $400 billion a month. And here's the other issue that's going to hit that. The economy is starting to slow down. We're seeing it, and the LEIs are rolling over. That's why some people are saying that we're going to see stagflation, lower economic growth, higher rates of inflation. And you can see it in the numbers. You can see it in the LEIs. And what happens when the economy slows down and rolls over, tax revenues fall. When tax revenues fall and government spending increases, those deficits get bigger. So, Chris, this isn't something that's going to go away quickly. And the other thing that we can learn from history, there's only four ways you take care of massive debts. One is austerity. That ain't going to fly. I don't know any politician or world leader that is telling the population or the citizens, you know what, we've got a debt problem. We're going to cut your benefits. We're going to cut spending. That's not going to go over well. The second is debt default, which you'll unlikely see in major countries like Europe, the U.S., or Japan, or even China. So that leaves third possibility, which is wealth redistribution. We'll talk about that. In the Build Back Bad plan, there was an increase in corporate rates, an increase in individual rates. California is talking about the biggest tax increase in history as they want to go to socialized medicine and get rid of all private health care in the state of California. In order to do that, they would have to pass tax increases that exceed the entire spending by the government of California. So redistribution, or what we call rising taxes, they are on the way. The other is printing money and to devalue the currency. So is the Fed going to stop printing money? I don't think so. They may stop temporarily with the taper, but what are they going to do, Chris, if, you know, here we are in the fall, we're months away from a midterm election. Do you think they're going to want the stock market down 20, 25% and the economy in a recession? I don't think so. The minute that trouble arises, I think you're going to see the Fed push back. And we saw this in the last decade, where they took about 5 years to raise the Fed funds rate to 2.5%. We were in an expanding economy, but the minute the market corrected and the economy began to slow down, what did the Fed do? Within a two-month period of time, they brought interest rates back down to zero, which is where they've kept them ever since.
So again, as we're mentioning, government policies are really driving a large portion of the inflation that we see today. And these policies are not changing quickly. In many cases, the trillions and trillions that have been spent, in addition to the massive reduction in goods and services that can be produced through the lockdowns and the disruption that that had on the global supply chain, these are things that are going to linger with us for much longer than people expect. That's what we've seen. And as we mentioned last year, Jim, there's really a fivefold process that we see in terms of the psychological narrative around inflation. The first step is that inflation is transitory, right? So we saw that as inflation was building, the Fed consensus economic thinking was, don't worry, inflation is transitory. The next stage after that, as inflation continues to build, is, well, transitory is lasting a little bit longer than we thought, right? And then we saw that. After that, it was, inflation is actually persistent, but you know what? Don't worry. We have the tools and the means to deal with it. And so that's about where we're at now, moving into the fourth stage, which is that the trade-offs are higher inflation are worth it. It's going to help to reduce debts, perhaps. And it'll actually help to correct certain imbalances. That'll be the fourth rationalization. The fifth and final policy prescription will just be outright price controls and higher taxes. So we're quickly moving towards that fifth and final stage, as we all know. But Jim, one thing I think when it comes to blind spots, like you're talking about around the long-term structural increase inflation that we see today, is energy prices. So let's get into that.
Yeah, this is one thing that we saw in the last decade, Chris, when the price of oil began to fall, when Saudi Arabia really pumped out a lot of oil to kind of damage the shale producers. It didn't work. It backfired. But the price of oil dropped below $100. In fact, during the COVID crisis, we actually got to negative rates in oil. The first time I've seen that in my investment career. But the real problem that we have here is the underinvestment. Wall Street said, hey, we don't want you going out and exploring and spending money. That didn't work very well for shale producers that didn't make money. So they were urging companies to cut back on exploration, buy back stock, raise dividends, which most of them did. And then on top of that, this transition to green energy, where you've got these woke portfolio managers that are getting elected to the boards of companies like Exxon, and we're having these companies divest themselves of their oil assets. It's like I have never seen an energy transition. Think back when we were at horse and buggy whip. It took multiple decades before we got to automobiles and freeways. And you think we're going to do electric cars and do away with fossil fuels in 10 years? It's not going to work. It's simply not going to work. And what we're seeing now is this whole decade of underinvestment. Even the IEA had to reverse course and say, wait a minute. No, we need you guys to start investing because, you know, you're not going to put a ship, a 787 in the air on batteries or solar panels. It's just not going to work. So it's going to take longer. And what we're seeing is this underinvestment is going to be raising the price of energy. We see $100 oil. I talked about $100 oil over a year ago. And on the day we're doing this, Chris, we're only about $15 away from that. So that's, you know, that's an easy one to see. And there are even some that are saying that we could see $150, $200 oil in this decade, which I think by mid-decade, we're going to have a major financial crisis, just as we have a major virus crisis globally. So the energy crisis is on its way, and you have no further to look to see what's going on in Europe, where natural gas prices are up over 400%, and there's all kinds of political machinations going on with pipelines. Who's going to supply the gas? And Chris, this isn't going away. It's just getting worse. It's all starting to backfire. And it's one of the reasons wages are going to be going up. Energy prices are going to go up. So this inflation issue is not going away.
Yeah. And case in point, let's just look at Germany. On the day that you and I are speaking, January 20th, German producer prices rise at fastest annual pace in history. And of course, going back to this being policy driven, Germany is the model of the ESG shift to renewable energies, right? They closed down their nuclear plants. They basically switched off their coal, their natural gas, and pushing heavily into wind and solar. And yet now, what are they facing? Massive, massive inflation with the fastest annual pace in history.
The other issue, too, and one of the fallacies of modern monetary theory is you can print as much money as you want and issue as much debt as you want when it's denominated in your own currency, like a sovereign currency like the U.S., the Japanese yen, or the euro. The problem with the U.S., if let's break down the closest figures, and I'm taking this right off the Treasury website. So at the end of December, total debt was $29,590,000,000. Of that amount, $23,137,000,000 was public debt. The rest of the debt, the $6.5 trillion, is money that the government has borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. We produced all these surpluses. The government spent those surpluses and issued IOUs. So if we take public debt, which right now, at least at the end of December, was $23 trillion, we take the amount that foreigners own of that, foreigners own 34% of our public debt. So that is putting the United States and the dollar at risk. And it's one of the reasons we are dollar bears on the dollar, because I think once the Fed pulls back after telling everybody it's going to fight, the first signs of trouble, they'll lay back and watch what happens to the dollar. So two of the key things, Chris, that we are watching going forward, watch gold, watch dollars, and watch the commodity indexes, because that's going to be the key in terms of the durability of this inflationary cycle.
So again, as we started telling listeners and investors, as early as 2020, right after the COVID crash, in the face of the massive government spending that we saw, and also the huge reduction to the global supply chain with lockdowns, the bottlenecks in supply, an inflationary wave is coming. There are a number of reasons that we outlined today for why these are structural in nature, and these are not things that are going to be going away anytime soon, and they are the direct result of government policy decisions. And as Jim, you said, in early 2020, investors need to be hedging this risk by investing in hard assets.
Well, absolutely. You've heard it from luminaries such as Ray Dalio, who said he wouldn't be in cash or bonds at this point. We heard that last week on the program from Pierre Lassan. He's in real estate. He's in basic commodities, gold and silver. And likewise, myself personally, I'm invested in real estate, dividend stocks, commodities, gold and silver. And the thing that we are recommending, we just had a new client come in, sold his business, is getting 50% of the money up front and then another 50% over 3 years. He has three or four real estate investments, so we're going to take a third of the net proceeds after taxes. That's going to go into real estate. He does very well in that. We told him to continue. We're also going to put a little over $300,000 or $400,000 in precious metals. And then we're going to put $200,000 in our dividend program, which is mainly oriented towards commodities where the biggest dividend increases are occurring. I mean, you have to do that. I mean, if you are in cash or in fixed income, and let's just take the 10-year Treasury note, which is over 1.8%. The official inflation rate is 7%. So you're automatically losing 5% a year in purchasing power. And Chris, I don't buy the 7% inflation number. I think it's probably twice that. So, you know, you take a look at the way the inflation numbers are modified due to hedonics and substitution. I mean, I don't care if you're looking at food, gas, utilities, any type of major goods, major ticket items, cars. They're going, everything's going up double digits. And so that's why you've got a hedge. This is going to be very much like the 00 decade, where it's going to be hard assets that are going to be the premier performers in this decade, along with what I call super growth stocks and dividend growers.
Well, Jim, to wrap things up, I think we should probably point to Ray Dalio's thesis, expect the U.S. and other major developed nations to inflate away these debts.
Yeah, he's written three books and principles. He's coming out with this fourth book that will be on investments. But this is kind of a summary from his second book called Big Debt Crises. And there's 8 points to it. First, financial crises tend to follow the same general pattern. You basically see whether it's tulips, whether it's real estate in the last decade. Second, financial crises are often built on new financial instruments that aren't properly regulated. Think of CDOs in the financial crisis in the 00 decade, or think of cryptocurrencies today. And financial crises, number three, financial crises tend to correspond with a sharp rise in populism on both sides of the political spectrum. We're seeing it with the Bernie Sanders wing. We saw it with the Tea Party. We saw it with Trump. So on both sides of the political aisle, populism rises when you see this. Number four, financial institutions are too important to let fail. I mean, if any of our major banks, I don't care if it's Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, Bank of America, we can't afford to have that happen. And that's why, going back to the days of Alexander Hamilton, he bailed out the banks when this country was first formed. And we've seen subsequent bailouts in major financial crises. Number five, in a financial bubble, investors become blind to the inevitability of a crash. They see nothing but good times and expect the current trends will last forever. Number six, upturns and downturns in the economy are self-reinforcing. And this is one reason why the Fed has got to be very careful, Chris, because right now consumers are flush with cash and savings due to stimulus checks and the lockdowns. What happens when the market crashes or pulls back 15-20%? The Fed has got to be very careful about consumer sentiment. When all of a sudden consumers start getting scared because they're seeing, you know, maybe their job's in jeopardy, the economy's slowing down, and they're seeing the market go down, maybe they're not feeling as wealthy, so they start to pare back on their spending. Number seven, policymakers who hesitate or undercorrect when an economic problem arises will likely fail to mitigate the financial crisis. Think of the Fed. Think of, for example, Alan Greenspan in 1996, his irrational exuberance speech. He made a speech, but that was all he did. He still printed money. Or think about some of the warnings that we have seen. Think of the Fed and the amount of money printing and the criticism that they stayed too long with their foot on the gas pedal. And they missed that, as you know, they were trying to say, hey, this is only transitory. Once COVID's over, supply chain ends, everything will be back to normal. Here we are 2 years later. That's not the case. So a lot of times these big policy guys, they miss the big picture. And number eight, the value of a given currency is constantly in flux. And one of the things that we see as a possibility are major devaluations across the major currencies, because just as the U.S. is accumulating massive amounts of debt, so is Europe, and so is Japan. And so look for this inflation cycle to continue and be longer lasting, Chris, until the debt cycle ends, which will be either in a massive devaluation, and you've heard this great word that's coming out of Davos with called the Great Reset. And that's what they're talking about.
Well, when it comes to investing in hard assets and making sure that you're protected against this long-term increase in inflation, which is our view, you have to keep in mind that this is a volatile sector. And hard assets, especially commodities, can see large moves up and large moves down, in which case it is important that you have an advisor or you have someone that's working to either shift you in and out of certain sectors or various commodities based on the moves that we see in the market. That is something that we do at Financial Sense Wealth Management, watching our clients' portfolios closely, overweighting, underweighting various sectors based on the investment landscape, and doing so accordingly as these events unfold. So if you want to give us a call to see how we can assist you, either through our money management services, our 401k services, or just for a general financial plan, all of which we provide, you can do so by giving our wealth advisors a call at 888-486-3939. You can also go to our website, financialsense.com, and click where it says contact us.
Couple parting comments. One of the things that you'll hear from people like Ray Dalio and even Pierre Lassonde is diversification of your hard assets. We're not recommending you put all your money in gold, which people, you know, there are a lot of people that will do just that. They'll put everything in gold and silver. You don't want to do that. You don't want to put anything all or everything all into commodities. You want real estate. You want dividend stocks. You want commodities. You want gold and silver and even foreign currencies, which is something we're also looking at too. So in the meantime, before we close, I want to point out we're going to put two links on our website. One is to the Treasury site that shows you the current deficit. You can actually click on it and just check by month. And what I really want you to do when you click on that site, go to September, which was the end of the government's fiscal year, and then go to December, which is the last full month of reporting. And we added over $1.1 trillion in debt in just 3 months. And then we're going to have another link that will show you debt to GDP ratios and will show you the deficit by year. And man, I tell you, is this an eye opener, especially if you take a look at where we've gone from the year 2000. Since the turn of the century, our national debt has gone up by almost 430%. It's now growing at over $400 billion a month. That's a scary thought. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.